Nord Stream. I got a good one on that. The Green Party is now calling for an official commission investigating Nord Stream. Did you know that? But do you know what they want to investigate? Not what happened to Nord Stream. They want to investigate why it happened, like why the Nord Stream pipeline happened. Like, how, right. You know, there must have been corrupt dealings that you know, the United States was always warning from day one that you don't build this pipeline. There were indeed some shady dealings that were, however, all legal, that a northeastern German state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern founded some sort of like pro-climate protection foundation that was funded by the state, but that really was trying to circumvent U.S. sanctions on the raw materials to finish building Nord Stream 2. And so the Greens are now like, why did this happen? Like, so not who exploded it and caused one of the biggest environmental catastrophes and an unprecedented attack on civilian infrastructure. There, you know, the news is slow. When Wagenknecht asked the government, as a member of the Bundestag, you have a right to sort of ask the government to reveal some secrets and say, like, what is internally known about X? When she asked, like, what is internally known about the explosion of Nord Stream? She was told, we cannot tell you for the welfare of the state what we know.
Everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. Just brief one for me today. I'm going to shortly pass you over to Philip Cunliffe, who will be talking to the writer Gregor Basak about Germany, German breakdown, indeed neoliberal order breakdown syndrome, German style. On the agenda today is German public life, moralizing hysteria, Germany's Europeanness, the country's position on the Ukraine war, and populist maneuverings on the left and the right. This is an episode that's initially only available to our subscribers at patreon.com/bungacast. We have a new episode every Tuesday and additional episodes on Thursday most weeks. Two episodes a month are free and all the rest are only on our Patreon, as you probably know by now. On there, you can find our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Catherine Liu, Amber Lee Frost, and Lee Phillips. We have episodes with writers and editors from Damage Magazine, with whom we're partnered. And if you sign up to our Patreon, you also get a free subscription to the very excellent Damage Magazine. And of course, there's plenty from the Bunga Boys, that's Phil, George, and myself. Just briefly, here's what you may have missed over the last month on BungaCast. We had renowned music critic Simon Reynolds on Future Music. Two episodes on various aspects of Mexican politics, society, and economy, as we delved into the elections that saw the hugely popular, but also in some circles controversial, left-wing President López Obrador leave office. You can hear Roger Lancaster and Juan David Rojas on those episodes. The Bunga Boys also had a big old row about the Zone of Interest and Holocaust movies in general. We replied to your questions and often angry comments on Israel and Palestine, and the Alex Garland film Civil War. And last week, we had the always insightful and brilliant Indian writer and activist Achin Van Eyck on the podcast to give us a full rundown of India's massive elections, what Narendra Modi is up to, and how he's different from national conservatives in Europe. I highly recommend that episode. I learned so much. And we also re-released our acclaimed obituary of Silvio Berlusconi, who died a year ago this month. Rest in peace. Check that one out if you missed it last year. Coming up, we have Who Owns Power on the Institution of Energy Utilities with Fred Stafford. That's later this week. Lee Phillips and I also talk to Korean scholar Hae-young Woo about free-falling fertility rates in South Korea and increasingly heated gender strife there. Catherine Liu will tell us about something she calls professional populists and their role in the culture war. The Reading Club will discuss the structure of post-Soviet Russian politics through the work of the late Dmitry Furman. And two episodes that were postponed due variously to illness or bereavement will finally be put out in early July. We will have Sam Chris on Saudi modernism and much else besides, and Eva Illouz on emotional capitalism and the effective traits of populism in Israel and beyond. All right, here's Phil talking to writer Gregor Basak.
So today we're having Gregor Basak on the show to talk about German politics. Gregor is a Chicago-based writer with bylines in the American Conservative, Antiwar.com, Cicero, Macroscope, Sublation, Unheard, and Gregor is also on Twitter, and you'll find some of his work and also his Twitter handle in the show notes. Hi, Gregor. Welcome to the pod.
Hi, how are you, Phil? Good to be on.
All right. Yeah, I'm glad to finally have you on. I've been meaning to have Gregor on for a while, and also in particular to talk about German politics. It's been somewhat remiss of us that we haven't spoken on the pod about German politics for a while, despite the fact that there is so much to talk about. Germany's obviously been in the news in relation to the Ukraine war, the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline, all of Germany's energy problems and industrial problems and so on, and more recently, how Germany fares with respect to the European parliamentary elections. So we're going to talk about all of that, or cover as much of it as we can, at least. But I also want to talk specifically about some of the pieces that you've written yourself, Gregor, because I think they're very useful and insightful in terms of giving us a sense of where German politics might be going. And you were, in fact, I remember having this conversation with you over Twitter. You're one of the first people to discuss with me the rumors that Sarah Wagenknecht was going to set up a party before she did. And so it's also, I'd like to talk about some of the backwash of her kind of the positions that she's trying to carve out in German politics at the moment. So if we begin, maybe if you could just give us a sense for our listeners at the moment, what your read of German politics is at the moment, where do things stand in terms of the current breakdown of the distribution of the relative strength of the different parties, where the government is, and what the major issues are of the day?
Yeah, for sure. What's noticeable right away is that up until over half a year ago, the AfD was for sure flying high in the polls. There were, you know, people were pretty much expecting that, and even on a national level, that they could get as much as a quarter of the share of votes. Right now, we're talking right before the EU parliamentary elections. It's weakened. It's kind of lost some support. It stands in various polls at about 15%, which is sort of celebrated in the German media as a huge success in the fight against anti-democratic forces. You shouldn't forget that that would still be the strongest that it ever has been on a national level. There was a regional election in the state of Thuringia, one of the former GDR states, in which on a sort of kind of statewide level, their share of votes was at about 29%. So the media was again saying, finally, you know, we've pushed back against the looming threat of the far right extremists from the AfD. But that was actually still a very, very strong outcome. But I would say that the campaigns and also some internal disputes within the AfD have certainly weakened it. It has dipped in the polls from its highs, which again, we have to remember that it's still is polling fairly highly. So where has that potential migrated? The CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, you know, the longtime leading party of Germany, Merkel, before that Kohl, were with our longtime chancellors, Adenauer, at the start of the Republic after World War II. It's now standing at about 30%, both in the EU elections, in the general sort of national polls and so forth. So there's been a move back of maybe some tacit support for the AfD into the CDU. It just feels like the safer option. I think people are definitely very dissatisfied with the ruling so-called traffic light coalition, named after the official party colors of the three parties that make up the current government of Germany, of the Social Democrats, the Green Party, and the sort of nominally free market, Free Democratic Party. It's an historically unpopular governing coalition. But usually, with a sort of lack of almost legitimacy for the system, for a lot of political parties in the last 20 years, the so-called protest parties have garnered a lot of that support. the link it did to some extent 10, 15 years ago when it polled in double digit on a national level, that then migrated to the IFD. I think right now people feel a little bit more assured again. The high energy costs of the year 2022, especially for industry, have subsided. So I think things are beginning to feel maybe normal again. And that's why I think for a lot of people, you know, the CDU seems to be a safer choice again. I think, you know, the media, politicians, activists shouldn't be so self-congratulatory. This feels like kicking the can down the road. Like eventually the IFD will be resurgent. I'm pretty sure at that.
So if you read kind of what I always like to do when we have guests on is to try and kind of, I suppose, penetrate through the surface of the kind of international liberal press, the English Anglophone kind of liberal press as it reports in countries around the world. So the kind of reports that we might get in The Guardian or The Economist or The Financial Times or The New York Times or, you know, The Washington Post and so on. And generally the kinds of stories that you get there in the moment will be talking about Germany's economic, economic troubles, Olaf Scholz kind of struggling, like you say, with the polls. Occasional stories about mishaps by the IFD. We'll talk about that a bit more in due course and so on. I was just wondering if there's any with an eye to looking a bit deeper than what those stories provide. Is there anything in the German press or that's current in German public life and discussions which doesn't filter upwards into those into that coverage? And is there any, what would you say we should be alert to in terms of how stories about Germany are framed in the Anglophone international media?
Well, you'll get literally the same framing that you get in the Anglophone media about Germany as you would get in the German mainstream media. It's the same concerns, the looming threat of the far right, of Putin, of attacks against democracy, of climate change and so forth. If you're a German yourself who relies largely on the sort of public news, public TV, evening news and so forth, I think the framing that you get in the UK and the United States would pretty much be reliably the same as you would get in Germany. I should say that I've lived in the United States for the last 10 years. So I always like to sort of link my experience to, you know, I read the German news every day, but, you know, you have to look past it to maybe get a bit more accurate and more, you know, information or stuff you don't necessarily get on the news. So that means my personal contacts and some political scenes, friends and family and regular visits back to my home country. And so it kind of feels like every time I go back, which is usually once a year for a month or two, it still has just qualitatively changed the discourse. The rhetoric seems to have changed. So in Germany, there's a lot of sort of anger and outrage. It's still comparatively marginal, but it's rising. But maybe if you're constantly in Germany, it's like the frog sitting in gradually increasing temperatures of water. Whereas for me, every time I go back, it seems like, whoa, something has again qualitatively changed. When I lived in Germany, I would generally not watch the TV evening news. They were always very stale and boring, right? They were kind of predictable. The major party leaders were on. But that was that, right? Or the Sunday evening talk shows, it was just politicians kind of grandstanding, but that was that. But if you watch the news now, for instance, there's a lot of lecturing. The tone has gotten very lecturing. There's no more really fine line. And as has been the experience all over the Western world, that you notice that opinion has snuck into reporting. Again, the sort of the big evening news show, the Tagesschau, which is on the public channel, ARD, it has gotten kind of very snarky, the threats to democracy are clear. Climate change is clear. I was home when the was it the Euro Cup that was caught up after COVID, right? That was the 1 year delayed Euro Cup. The TV broadcasters before they talked about the game, they had to comment on the fact that there's far too many people in the Wembley Stadium, right? That was so. So it's gotten very lecturing in tone. the fact that the culture war just seems to be so prominent now that the government now passed a new transgender legislation where you can change your gender in your national ID once a year. It is happening. It's so interesting because, you know, the joke has always been, the observation has always been, and, you know, Alex wrote his famous essay about the triumph of American idealism, that, you know, the world just has to live sort of in the American political arena. That seems to have been sort of the experience for the past, you know, 80 years or so. I think, you know, in the 50s, one spoke of Coca colonization. It's been a joke, but it's really true that Germany still is in that sort of habit of catching up on sort of U.S. cultural politics with a few years delay. So when you notice here in the United States that wokeness is sort of, you know, the Democrats have sort of, you know, made a bit more silent. Pride Month is not as prominent anymore in corporate communications. It's all over in Germany, right? Same with sort of wokeness. Wokeness is the big topic now, whereas in the United States it has gotten kind of muted, which, again, is very interesting. Which also has sort of created this cottage industry of anti-woke activism, of anti-woke sort of media and online social media celebrities and writers who are cautioning against it. A lot of these dynamics have sort of sprung up. It definitely doesn't feel like the country that I left 10 years ago. But the country I left 10 years ago was the sort of post-political, post-historical kind of, the government will manage it. Merkel had this sort of assuring, whatever happens, happens, we're going to get through it. Whatever the crisis was, we're going to get through it kind of nature. Whereas now it feels a lot more rambunctious and chaotic. That's always surprising. And it always strikes me with every visit, every time I dip into the sort of arena back home, that is just, you know, turned up noticeably more.
So where does that rambunctious kind of aspect come from, if the public broadcaster is kind of lecturing and hectoring and sounding more shrill and defensive? Where do you get the sense of the rambunctious atmosphere?
That's a good question. I mean, that's a lot about Germany is not clear, right? Like, why are they doing the things that they're doing? Once again, I don't actually want to fully blame it on sort of the impact of the United States, right? That I think that can also be exaggerated, but certainly sort of the sort of academic culture war generation that grew through the ranks in the United States in the 80s is now in power in the media and the nonprofits and so forth. I think that happened with a delay. You know, a lot of the culture studies programs, you know, they kind of looked toward the United States. They created their own graduates in Germany now, and now they're in the media. When I wrote my first piece for this sort of, you know, fairly mainstream center-right magazine, Cicero in Germany, which is one of definitely the better news publications. When I spoke on the phone with the editor, he said, you know, what was striking is that I didn't know where you stand on the topic that you reported in the piece, which for me as someone whose responsibility is to get interns, to get new writers, it's very hard to find that. There's a lot of sort of intent to get the right message across among a young generation of journalists. I think the more sinister explanation, however, is that just as in the United States and in the UK, you do have a lot of these organizations that sprung up before 2016, you know, as Jacob Siegel likes to remind people, that are the sort of like misinformation and disinformation complex institutions, right? So 2016, you know, it became inevitable to hear and see this on the news around Brexit, around Donald Trump in Germany, and the fear of the rise of the AfD in France, with the fear about the rise of Le Pen, that you know, we have to get the voters back on course. But a lot of these institutions already predated 2016. The infrastructure was already in place. People always talk about sort of the misinformation, disinformation complex actors. People sometimes forget also organizations like Bellingcat, which gets regularly cited in the German media, which people sort of claim has CIA proximity, something that Bellingcat, of course, vigorously denies. There's the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. There's all these organizations that, you know, have occupied the news in the UK, that Unheard has been sort of, you know, raging against. They have also been in place. I listened to some Zoom recording of a conversation of the Alliance of Democracies, which was founded in 2017 by the former Danish Prime Minister, NATO Secretary General, that is very active in sort of the disinformation observation, election monitoring complex in Germany, flagging false narratives and so forth. If you join these calls, Green Party politicians will be on there, SPD politicians will be on there. I saw a talk with a Spiegel, their Spiegel journalist, one of our biggest sort of news magazines in Germany that is sort of very regime obedient. Didn't always used to be the case. There are always these a lot of the time it's Der Spiegel who has the stories about, you know, the latest Russian disinformation campaign. And I've seen definitely people who's with bylines on those pieces who have been on these calls of these disinformation censorship complex organizations. So there's also this institutional level that we shouldn't forget. That's my best explanation.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to hear, and it's also interesting to hear how centralized so many of these efforts seem to be, you know, given the fact that it's not just the Anglophone world, but also other countries too. Before we talk a bit more about that, I was just wanted to talk a bit about your own personal politics within all this, and I suppose it's a fitting segue from the way you've talked about how German politics itself has evolved. So our listeners will kind of both see in the show notes and also see from what we've said already that you published across a kind of a politically, what seems to be at first glance at least, a politically wide spectrum, right? So from Unheard and the American Conservative to Sublation Media and the Platypus Review. And just in the interest of full disclosure, I should say also that Gregor has written two reviews of books that I've written or been involved with, namely Lenin Libs from 2017, which Gregor reviewed for the Platypus Review, and then more recently reviewed my co-authored book, Taking Control on Brexit, which Gregor reviewed for Sublation Media. So I was curious, I'm curious, and I assume our listeners are curious too, about how you place yourself politically with kind of bylines that run or that are kind of cut across that political spectrum in a kind of orthogonal way. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, maybe I wouldn't write my review of Lenin Lives the way I did back then, kind of celebratory. I mean, the book was great and fantastic, but my own politics have evolved, and I don't think it's really that sort of dramatic or interesting. I think it maybe a lot of people have gone through the same experiences in the last years where old sort of ideological certainties don't seem quite as certain anymore. I think, you know, I was probably already on the way out of sort of an ideologically committed left come 2019, 2020. The events in the United States, again, as a German immigrant to the United States, the events of 2020 were very shocking to me. I mean, it gets underplayed.
Well,
in the
meaning
media.
Specifically?
The riots. Certainly lockdown too, but I mean, there was what felt like a color revolution, going on, and sort of the left in its publications seemed to be muting that, being okay with that, saying that belongs to the American experience, like occasionally we will riot and so forth. But, you know, dozens of people died, dozens of innocents died officially. There were a lot of murders that happened also because police were distracted. So what happened is that I, at that time, already sort of feeling some disenchantment with some just political, basic political, you know, philosophical assumptions that leftism holds, was kind of very personally shocked by that. And I sent around some emails and I always had, you know, good relations with people from the left to the right. I sent an email to a sort of conservative publicist, being like, I think I'm conservative now. I'm so thankful for his answer. And he said, look, it doesn't really, it's not about ideological labels. Like you don't have to call yourself that. It's fine if you don't, right? These are confusing times for everybody. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of you listeners have sort of been going through these same experiences. Like, wait, what's going on? Right. And he sort of kind of assured me that, you know, just read, just try to, you know, keep a clear mind about what's going on. And that was I'm very glad about that. I would like to say eventually I would have arrived at the same conclusion, right? I just don't have much ideological zeal anymore, right? To say like, I definitely have to have the leftist response to this or a conservative response to this. A lot of these labels, I think are exhausted. I always used to hate that sort of rhetoric. Left and right don't matter anymore.
Me too. Because it was always the Blairite kind of line, wasn't it? Kind of transcending left and right was part of the post-ideological, post-political move.
And certainly I think these terms do have meaning. They express real sort of class and you know, philosophical developments that are just real. So I'm trying to say that that's not that for me. I think probably like many people, I just haven't found it. I think we're in a transitional period in the history of modern capitalism, in the history of bourgeois society. We seem to be experiencing a slide toward clear authoritarianism from our so-called liberal democratic elites, right? The more they talk about defending democracy, the more I feel like something's up, because someone who's truly virtuous won't tell you that they're virtuous all the time, right? That to me is a tell. So I think it's just a disorienting time. The American conservative is just on foreign policy. It's just great. I mean, and I think people with a sort of leftist background have published their too. I think, you know, the sort of imperial adventures of the United States are very damaging to its own internal democracy. Empire hurts internal democracies. That's been known since Thucydides, right? And I think that's sort of their ultimate sort of thrust that I think very agreeable. I don't have any fear of being in contact and conversation with all sorts of political orientations. I think, again, a lot of people seem to be feeling that.
So do you, when you think about your own kind of responses politically, do you still classify them as coming from a particular left perspective or right perspective? Do you have any kind of, you said you don't feel the kind of the pressure to distill a particular kind of ideologically coherent response, but do you still kind of feel the tug or tug pulling, the tug, I suppose, of different political orientations pulling in different directions?
Yeah, depends on the day, right? Ask me something easier. I used to write hot takes around 2020, and I will never do that again. I think I've sort of struck a reporting tone, which I hope comes through in my writing. That I think it's about laying out the facts for the readers, but also for myself about what's going on. I mean, I like Christopher Lash, as many people who are finding themselves in my situation. I think Robert Nisbet, who is again, he's sort of a key figure in the founding of American Conservative, but he's far more complicated in actually placing him ideologically. He was very critical of a lot of the developments in that. I think, you know, in American politics, conservatism wasn't really a term used until the 1950s as a sort of clear defining ideological line. I think it's still kind of not a very helpful term, because, you know, the joke is the Republicans don't tend to conserve anything. If you put a gun to my head, probably social democratic and economics and more culturally conservative, like again, like a lot of people. And we know that that's sort of the golden spot in the political campus where in fact, most people in the Western world tend to locate themselves, that the change that's going on in our cultural sphere seems to be a roller coaster that is just dizzying in what's going on, that seems irrational. I think, you know, a lot of the sort of social model that for example, Germany has pursued after World War II in the Western Federal Republic was very successful in creating a sort of class peace, right? Do I think that, you know, a class war is imminent and that it's also absolutely necessary? Maybe not. That's where reading James Burnham was very interesting, seeing that, you know, that even in a sort of allegedly, ostensibly bottom-up democratic structure, you know, elite networks will form, and that people kind of want that too. They want to delegate some power. So again, it's I would say kind of heterogeneous in what I'm trying to read. Again, with the number one goal of keeping a clear mind, of making sense of what's going on.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure, and I, you know, I'm very sympathetic to a lot of what you say, and I'm sure many of the listeners are too. And I think also, you know, if anyone is politically kind of honest with themselves, or anyone at least who spends the time to think about this, any of these questions, I think they'd probably have feelings and thoughts along similar lines. So that takes us directly to some of what I wanted to speak about in terms of what you've written, which is particularly beginning with a piece for the American Conservative published mid-May this year, where you talk about it's called What's the Matter with Germany, and listeners will find it in the show notes, listeners, viewers will find it in the show notes. And you're talking about the possible disintegration of the kind of prevailing economic model within Germany, the so-called transatlantic center. And before we talk about what you see as the drivers of collapse, can you just outline what is the transatlantic center and how has it ruled Germany up to this point?
I think in Western European politics in the first decades after the Cold War, there was essentially, you know, that model will have the United States sort of sort out the political relations between the Western European countries outside the Warsaw Pact, provide a balancing function there, integrating into NATO and so forth. I think there were good reasons for doing that. I'm not a Stalin fan, and Stalin was pursuing a genuinely expansionist policy at the time that seemed threatening. From France came the sort of counterexample of Gaullism, right? Of de Gaulle, who was more anti-American, he was explicitly anti-American, who wanted to get the United States off the continent as quickly as possible, who certainly had aspirations for France to be strong, but, you know, as part of a sort of more united Europe. I think these were the two main strains. The latter has died out. The Gaullist side has died out in Germany, right? It is all transatlanticism all the time, down to Die Linke. When Die Linke officially, 10, 20 years ago, was demanding for Germany's exit from NATO, there's a famous case where a conversation by the leading Linke politician, Gregor Gysi, was leaked, where he assured, I forgot who he spoke to, probably some generals or Western leaders, saying that, by the way, we don't mean it with NATO exit. Right, we don't actually mean it. So you can be assured that if we ever enter a government and a state, and definitely national level, that Germany is going to be safely aligned with that. Institutionally, there were institutions set up in the early days of the Cold War and of the Western Federal Republic that tried to tie German intellectuals and politicians to the United States. Quickly, the question of rearming Germany came up in the early to mid 50s, potentially giving Germany nuclear weapons to serve as a bulwark against what felt like an impending, I think unjustifiably, like an impending Soviet invasion and so forth. There were organizations founded like the Atlantic Brücke, or the Atlantic Bridge, which I think has existed since 1952, that sort of tried to, create a literal bridge, a figurative bridge, I would say, between the United States and Germany, among politicians and intellectuals, to try to tie them ideologically and politically to the Western alliance. There was the famous Cultural Cold War that some people might have heard about. You know, the story is always that, yeah, you know, the ugly paint splashes of Jackson Pollock, the reason why they became so famous is that the CIA paid for them to be exhibited internationally, thus ruining a genuinely organic and beautiful American realism. That happened in Germany too. Magazine, you know, the Germany had a its own kind of chapter of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. It had magazines related to that, one of the sort of key sort of intellectuals magazine, political intellectual magazine in these decades was Der Monat, The Month, that turned out had, you know, had CIA funding. So the thing that was that sort of looked like might happen to Italy going communist, or potentially France having a strong communist party, had to be stopped in Germany. In the '50s, the German Communist Party was officially banned. By the German government under the same sort of principles that they are sort of hoping and maybe long-term trying to ban the IFD. The German government can do that. In retrospect, a lot of sort of legal historians say that the ban of the German Communist Party was very unjust. Part of the ruling was that they're not committed to the Western Alliance. From the get-go, there were intellectual networks set up that persist to this day. I think that those are some of the best explanations I can give.
Yeah. And
Turn off my microphone.
Oh, there you go. So could you tell us a bit more about how transatlanticism manifests itself today concretely in German politics?
As the only game in town, probably. At a moment of the strongest strain in the recent time of between Germany and the United States around the Iraq War, the Atlantic Bridge put out a page long, you know, big page ad in the New York Times saying, hey, by the way, we're still cool, right? So the CDU at the time when Gerhard Schröder stood up against the United States along with France and Russia in opposing the Iraq War, the CDU at the time would have had Germany join the so-called Alliance of the Willing, right? Today, again, it seems to be the only game in town. Schröder, I tend to defend him on some things. He was the so-called Genosse der Bosse, the comrade of the bosses. He led a sort of neoliberal pro-business policy. He did seem to attempt to carve out a sort of European Germany integrated into a sort of larger European network. I think, you know, he gets accused of having had corrupt intent in building Nord Stream and negotiating the contracts because he ended up serving on the board of Nord Stream 2. But it also had the feeling of like this might be the new European steel and coal community, pretty much the predecessor of you know, economic and political integration, and a community that existed in the 1950s. To create bonds between France and Germany at the time, that seemed what Nord Stream felt like today. So, especially among the Social Democrats, up until 2022, there was a clear faction that wasn't pro-Russia, that wasn't pro-Putin, but that was in favor of these projects. They, you know, currently most popular politician of Germany is our defense minister. Who belonged to, you know, Boris Pistorius, who belonged to a sort of German-Russia friendship organization. These ties existed, and that sort of died from one day to the next. So if you were to find not anti-transatlanticism, but something that hoped to also put Europe on its own footing, you could have found that among the Social Democrats. That has died out. Pistorius, who again was kind of tentatively pro-Russia or at least for friendship with Russia, is now rabidly anti, wants to integrate Germany even more strongly, the German armed forces even more strongly into NATO, wants to prepare us for war in 2029 and so forth. One of the flips that was switched in 2022 where even sort of the most cautious sort of voices that called for walking some sort of more independent line from the United States have died out.
So just quickly, I want to talk more in depth about the kind of the mechanics of possible disintegration you talk about in peace. But just quickly on that, because I saw that story about the defense minister saying we have to prepare for war with Russia by the end of the 2020s. And it just seemed to me so extraordinary how, you know, the kind of the entirely blasé and offhand way it was reported on the international scene. This comment by a German defense minister talking about war with Russia, you know, not least around that it was kind of just a few days before the commemoration of D-Day. How did it go down in Germany? Like such an extraordinary statement, so kind of belligerent, but also with seemingly such little self-awareness about the German past with relation to Russia.
amongst more critical voices, which you would find in alternative media and on Telegram, you know, this was a shock. But I felt like that blew over very quickly in the mainstream media. I think in general that the sense is that even in the United States, the media tends to be more critical of the course that was set in, which is quite something, because the United States is very regime, the U.S. media is very regime friendly, they're regime stenographers. It gets criticism. I mean, the education secretary said that in German schools they should train for war. I mean, you know, and so forth. I think, again, you know, as I've acknowledged, I live in the United States, so I don't have the day-to-day contact. But in my, you know, conversations with friends and family, it's not a topic. It seems to be something that is sort of more uncomfortably sort of glossed over. I've definitely heard from more normie relations that, oh no, Russia's going to invade. Russia's going to invade. And no, they wouldn't. They wouldn't just out of the blue invade. I think that's maybe one of the drivers. I mean, it's scare tactic politics that these sort of news get put out. I mean, certainly the fact that, you know, that story just came out that Germany's planning for, like, what happens in the case of invasion. I mean, I hope they did that even before, you know, the Ukraine-Russia conflict. The nation should be ready for any eventualities. But that you get more and more stories like that. You know, they do seem to be getting some pushback. Germans, by and large, in polls, are very against, you know, sending, you know, the Taurus cruise missiles into Russia. They're very against a more active involvement. But yeah, again, like I said, from normies you hear, you know, they're going to invade. So I think it's maybe a media and political campaign that's been successful in planting this idea in people's minds. When you know, the latest phase of the Ukraine war broke out in 2022, I saw on LinkedIn, like, some, you know, Bundeswehr, so German Armed Forces officer, you know, said, I just got my old uniform out of the closet and I'm ready to serve and so forth. I think Germans are just not used to this sort of, like, militaristic rhetoric. We professionalized our army when I was 18. I still had to go through, like, a medical checkup for potential, you know, the draft, which was just like a 9-month service that you could opt out. They banned that, tried to make the army a professional army, have them serve in, you know, in Mali, defending French colonial interests. Like, why? I don't know. So that seemed like something distant, like, nobody I know knows anybody who was in the German armed forces. But now the sort of militaristic discourse has just seeped through. And I think with elites, it's just something where they kind of feel cool and powerful, and like they're world historical actors again, like they're playing a big chess game. I think if you read elite theory and so forth, that's something that genuinely drives elites, this pop, that the sense of now we're in some sort of, like, leading role and trying to shape the chessboard. Like I said, otherwise it's something that maybe gets passed over in silence more generally.
So having given us a sense of the transatlanticism and in German politics and since the end of the Second World War, can you tell us a bit about your thesis or your claim that we might be on the brink of seeing it disintegrate now? Why? What are the signs in your mind, and what is the argument?
So the passage you're referring to was a long quote I provided from the very controversial AfD politician Maximilian Krah, who is the lead candidate of the AfD. He's been asked to not be as vocally present in the campaign anymore because he's just a very outspoken kind of troll. Essentially, he gave the 6.5-hour podcast interview, that a podcast that is sort of watched on the German center left. And as part of that interview, he sort of said, like, you know, he was asked, what do you think is going to happen? And I think the vision he gave, is plausible, that this is not the AfD's moment. Like, again, like I said, it's lost about 10% on a national level from its previous highs, that what we're looking at is probably some sort of Green and CDU, Christian Democratic Union Alliance, in the next government. It doesn't have to be. It's something they clearly want, that even the CDU would probably prefer to a coalition with the Social Democrats, like the so-called Grand Coalition. So that seems to be something that's coming. And Klaus's argument is that it will feel like change, like a vote for change, like voting for the CDU. Like they're going to get us back to the old ways of stability and safety and economic prosperity. But if you look at their program, it's like with the Tories and Labour. They pursue largely the same policies, and that the CDU Green coalition seems to be like a match made in heaven. They might eventually, in the end, that government might look just the same like the Scholz government. I think Merz is more someone who would be more in charge than Scholz is, who's just sort of bumbling along, who's fairly uncharismatic and just seems like he's being like he's a pushover. Like he speaks up, doesn't want to do something, hears some criticism, and eventually, caves. Merz would be a bit of a clearer leader. And I think the hope there is that eventually, somehow, the situation in Europe and the international economy will stabilize. The German economy will stabilize, and that will sort of re-legitimize, the centrist governing parties. Krass' thesis is that if they rule the same and those crises do not get resolved, that the AfD's moment will eventually come, right?
The argument is there. So Scholz kind of stumbles on. The CDU Greens come to power as a kind of vote for change in the next elections in Germany. And then after that is the real moment of the possible disintegration of this kind of transatlanticist center. Is that the basic argument?
Yeah, that was Klaus's argument that I find plausible. It's a prediction, so who knows what's happening. But again, I don't think the EU will resolve its structural internal problems. The larger this organization grows, the more, displeased people on a national level get with it. Adding members to NATO makes the entire alliance less secure because you're adding, their interests suddenly to the alliance. So I don't think there's anything on the horizon that makes it seem like the structural problems that the EU, that NATO, the Western world are facing are being resolved. That they will sort of, that the CDU will come in and manage decline. The so-called protest vote, the middle finger to the establishment parties, will eventually return, and that be it the AfD, be it, Sarah Wagenknecht's new party will probably down the road get more support. Who knows? Maybe another political project will emerge, right? Germany had a lot of stability after World War II because it had so few parties. And now with every year, there seems to be a new party project emerging so it's an uncertain future. The certainty is not resolved. The uncertainty is not resolved. And these parties are managing the decline more so than turning it around. And I think down the road, who knows what might happen.
So do you have are you willing to call the shot anyway, like any particular way in terms of what might happen in the aftermath of a CDU Green government?
Oh, that's just one of those questions where in the end you can only be wrong and people will point the finger at me. Let me put it this way. I think before AfD or any anti-system parties emerge, we'll just drop the pretense of liberal democracy and a more open authoritarianism will emerge. That would be my best guess. Like right now, it feels like a show everywhere anyway. Maybe we're going to get a technocratic government, but maybe they'll just straight up ban the AfD and just deal with the fallout that if you ban a huge opposition party, people would be angry, but maybe they're gonna just sort of try to sit this one out or stick it out and sort of crack down on any dissent. I think if anything, authoritarianism would be the solution to the coming of truly oppositional or anti-systemic parties.
So this takes us to the other end of the political spectrum, or perhaps not the other end, depending on your one's view of the matter, I suppose. But we mentioned Sarah Wagenknecht, and you did you wrote a piece in towards the end of last year for Unheard about Sarah Wagenknecht as a potential tribune of the people, the left-wing maverick who could stop the AfD. And more recently, there is something of the controversy on the left because she had an interview published in New Left Review, which drew a lot of ire from left-wing commentators who felt it was illegitimate to give somebody who is essentially conservative, if not something, I don't know, fascist adjacent or something like that, to give her a platform in the leading journal, theoretical journal of, still is leading theoretical journal of the international left. So could you talk us through where, so you wrote that piece in October. Wagenknecht seems to have made kind of much more of a kind of mark in the last few months. So could you tell us a bit about how things have changed since you wrote the piece and where things stand with Wagenknecht and her party at the moment?
Yeah, here's where predictions, you know, can come back to haunt you, because I in my piece, I cited a poll where about 20% of Germans reported that they could consider voting for her. And so I think I wrote a line that, who knows, if that party gets constituted, it might leapfrog into second place. And now it's at 7%, which among its supporters is sold as a huge success, right? Like a new party. And suddenly we're at 7%, which is true, right? Who knows if the structures grow and they get more rooted in sort of local party structures, that sort of over the long term might get stronger. I think the short term expectation for a lot of people was going to be, this is going to be like this new populist project that is going to be this left wing alternative to the AfD, but they're still going to talk about a lot of the same issues, and it's going to be rabble rousing and strong and so forth. And then they sort of feel like they've just kind of swallowed a lot of disenchanted members of Die Linke, of the left party. And maybe some people from other parties. I mean, there are former, you know, Social Democratic Party members who one of the two lead candidates for the EU is a former SPD politician. But maybe like with all the sort of realignment talk in the United States, it ended up being just sort of like an intellectual's fantasy that we're going to get like our cool sort of semi-conservative but still social democratic populist party, and it's going to storm to the front. I think the rollout was a bit bad. There were these rumors in the news that this party is coming, that she's going to split from Die Linke. And so let's see how it's going to be announced. And the way it ended up being announced was in this very stale environment of the official sort of press conference building of the German government. It's actually a nonprofit. It's this very stale background. And she led a panel of former Linke politicians, but also a sort of entrepreneur, a businessman. And I think they tried to sort of sell themselves as a sort of respectable alternative to sort of the traffic light coalition, which Sarah Wagenknecht called the worst government in modern German history, in the history of the Federal Republic since World War II, that they are the worst government, that they will get a lot of that sort of momentum going. But it's still built around the person Sarah Wagenknecht. The party is called the Alliance Sarah Wagenknecht. They are saying that they want to come up with a new and better name. But right now, given that she's so recognizable and still fairly popular, that just for the first big elections that we're running, being the EU elections, they did run in local elections recently, did comparatively well, that people will just recognize the name and they're going to operate around that. It's I think to a lot of people, it's not necessarily clear for which the party stands. But again, it also just doesn't seem as sort of, I keep saying, rabble-rousing and populist and a fuck you to the system like the AfD does. However you feel about them, the AfD feels like a truly anti-system party, whereas Wagenknecht, I think, has communicated that they're open. They really ideally would want to have a coalition with the Social Democrats, that they just want to get the Social Democrats back to their old 1970s Willy Brandt era roots, right? Where they definitely were left of center as a party.
Pressure group on the SPD then?
That's what it feels like, right? I mean, the AfD line was that because of all this talk, because they've categorically excluded any collaboration with the IFD, that they are a spoiler party, that they are trying to drive a wedge in the anti-sort of system, anti-mainstream opposition. Could be true. Yeah. I don't think she has that intention, right? But I think she has a dream that, you know, behind the scenes, someone from the BSW, the Sarah Wagenknecht party that I talked to, said that when I sent her my American Conservative piece about the coming CDU Green coalition, that person said, you know, that's a disaster. The CDU should go into a coalition with Sarah Wagenknecht instead, right? And someone I deeply respect, and who knows, there's a case to be made, but surely they know that they would have to fundamentally transform the Christian Democrats for that to become, you know, plausible and in a way in which people would know that the party hasn't immediately sold out, right? So I think with the slow rollout, the sort of a bit stale, bland rollout, and the fact that they are still right away out of the gate trying to position themselves as a far more respectable, stabilizing force, that they might not have gained that potential, truly oppositional potential that is just out there among the German electorate.
What did you make of her interview in the New Left Review? How significant is it? And also, does it tell us anything that's kind of important to note? I mean, one thing that struck me was how clear she was about the so-called Mittelstand, supporting this kind of spine of German middling industries, small family-owned businesses and so on that have been crucial to the German economic miracle in the post-war era and the backbone of the larger industrial kind of export-oriented growth model that Germany has had. And she was very concerned with them because they're the ones who are particularly kind of squeezed by inflation and energy prices. And so the New Left Review interview seemed to me, I mean, given the audience, it seemed like a curious place perhaps, but it seemed to me very much a pitch essentially to the Mittelstand in terms of her political kind of, her political offer seemed to be essentially that way.
That is her pitch. That is the way that she's trying to attract non-leftist voters because, you know, we have to remember for her entire mature political life, adult political life, she was a leftist and a far leftist at that, especially in the 90s. She was associated with the sort of, left of the then Party of Democratic Socialism kind of group links. She was when Die Linke formed, Die Linke consisted of various so-called platforms of various kind of factions that she belonged to the sort of Stalinophile, let's call it, communist platform from which she distanced herself. And then like around 2009 to 2011, she sort of reinvented her image as saying that, you know, the early Federal Republic had it right. What the Germans call the social market economy is the right model. She sort of dropped anything sounding like she might try to bring about socialism to sort of gain respectability. I mentioned they had this sort of businessman on that official first press conference when they announced the project. That was supposed to be a sign to business, right? Don't fear us. We're not going to bring about a planned economy. And I think that is the pitch that she's sort of going to unite the Mittelstand, the sort of small and medium-sized businesses, which make up 99% of all existing businesses in Germany. But another statistic we shouldn't forget is that they make up slightly over half of employees, right? The few 1% large companies make up almost half of all employees in Germany. But her pitch was to sort of this, I don't know, I mean, how familiar he is in the UK, but, you know, in the United States, a sort of kind of anti-monopolistic voice is like someone like Matt Stoller. To me, she sounds a little bit like him, that's sort of the line she's trying to strike, that's a sort of like realignment politics that you would get where, you know, again, it's an intellectual's fantasy that people like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance in the United States are going to drive the coming of some sort of like cautiously social democratic, but culturally still conservative new party, which doesn't seem to truly be emanating. But that's kind of what she sounds like. And I think that's sort of what she's trying to offer.
Is there anything else about the New Left Review interview you thought was interesting or important?
she sounded just a bit more technical, because in Germany, she just, when she's interviewed by German media, she just tries to sound more populistic and simple. I think that's something that she actually does very well. She speaks very not simplistically, but speaks a very simple German. I think knowing that she spoke to an intellectual audience, that's something. But I mean, a lot of that seemed, you know, familiar to me, right?
Yeah.
So maybe rhetorically, it's just sounded a little bit different. But that was the Wagenknecht that most journals know.
So I wanted just to circle back to the man you've already mentioned, Maximilian Krah, who you interviewed in October last year, and he's a member of the AfD in the EU Parliament, and he's recently been in the news for saying that not all of the SS were criminals, and this has caused kind of consternation. And resultingly, he's been pushed kind of out, or it seems like he's been kind of pushed out of the limelight as a result, and he's been taken as to symbolize some of the political trouble that the AfD has been in recently. The title of that interview was "The Europe After America," and it's again, listeners and viewers will find it in the show notes. It's a very detailed, an interesting interview, partly because I think it's somebody who who's kind of thoughtful and intelligent, formed, views. And also it seems to speak to, there is like something like a political vision there at the core of kind of independent or political independence for Europe might look like if they're breaking out of the American orbit. And so I'm curious to hear, I mean, I was wondering if you could talk us through it a bit, but also it seems out of kilter with making not only kind of such a, kind of crass remark, but also one that seems so kind of tactically misguided and foolish in the context of German public debate. So I was wondering if you could talk us, kind of give us your assessment of Krah and where things stand with the AfD.
Yeah, I mean, maybe for the AfD, the old faulty tower rule goes, just don't mention the war, right? Because the war is mentioned a lot. It's part and parcel of German national identity to think actively about the war, right? To build memorials to that. And the AfD has been, the other sort of probably even further right kind of prominent politician than Krah, Björn Höcke, had, famously gave a speech saying that, it's a national shame to put the Holocaust memorial in Berlin. Like, what other country would memorialize a shameful event that it's sort of disintegrating, it doesn't help form a coherent national body and a national body politics and so forth. I think Krah's problem is, I think you mentioned that he's very intellectual. There was this famous 6.5-hour interview on this sort of mainstream podcast where he held his own, that it went on for 6.5 hours live, and that, the moderator was very prepared and tried to trick him and to this and that, and isn't this a really far right thing? And I think he came across as far more moderate to many. But again, that's more of maybe a kind of an online crowd. He's very popular sort of among the kind of really truly activist, nationalist wing of the AfD, whereas I think he's not that great of a public speaker. His acceptance speech when he got nominated for the AfD as their lead candidate, he likes to dress nice and sport expensive watches, and he's clearly an intellectual, so he doesn't have the sort of beer tent kind of populist appeal. And the fact that he just, I think, the question was fairly innocuous. Like, were all members of the SS criminals? And his defense is like, what about the Nobel Prize winning writer Günter Grass, right? Who, when he was young, got drafted against his will into the SS. I don't know what else he could have at that moment answered, to be quite fair. But, he will host panel discussions about, like, who's truly at fault for World War II was the Poles or Germany. Like, you know, why would you do that? I've heard criticism from IFA sympathizers who said, you know, who told me, like, why is he doing these things, right? So I think, again, he's probably very popular with the truly activist base with the IFD, but with the sort of centrist factions in the leadership of the IFD who have been conceiving the party for the last years is just becoming an acceptable partner in a coalition to the CDU, that he's just sort of, you know, stepping in it all the time. Right, the CDU, especially Merz, has said we have a firewall. We will never collaborate with the IFD. They violate the old CDU rule that there should be no alternative to the right of the Christian Democratic and Christian Social Union parties in Germany. So I think they were never that open to begin with. But there's definitely this faction that just wants to be sort of a CDU of old, a CDU as you would have known them from the 1980s. That he certainly doesn't represent. He's certainly more nationalistic in ways that is uncomfortable for Germans.
Yeah, and in this context also, so Marine Le Pen, the French national populist leader, used the opportunity of his statement about the SS to make a move, basically, it seems, to kind of strengthen her alliance with Meloni and kind of eject or contain the AfD, I suppose, in advance of the European parliamentary elections. And this seemed to me a very kind of clear, essentially a clear, you know, she was laying out a stake essentially to leadership with Meloni of the kind of European, of the right in the European parliamentary elections and as a whole across the continent, essentially a pitch for leadership. And it seemed to me kind of tactically clever. But also I wondered if there was anything more to it beyond, you know, that you could see, because it seemed very, her determination, I suppose, to keep the AfD out, I would seem to me puzzling on the face of it, because it seems to me like, you know, why not, it shouldn't be too difficult to concoct some kind of block or alliance in the European Parliament between the three of them. I mean, why do you think it was necessary for for Le Pen to keep out the AfD?
I think more so than about EU parliamentary politics, it was about her presidential ambitions. She has been the sort of second place candidate in what is it, the last two presidential cycles. She would she went into the runoff twice, right? And then the same happened as with her father in 2002, that all the other parties unite against her. I think it's far more realistic, but they would have to ask a French expert, that she might actually become president next time. And I think she just has to strike this sort of moderate, sort of Gaullist, centrist tone. I think she was looking for just any reason to cut ties. And that one felt a bit sort of forced, because again, I think the statement itself, there are worse statements that IFD politicians have made from the perspective of World War II revisionism, probably, than saying, look, we're all of our ancestors criminals. Like, it's a whole can of worms. Like, what does that term mean? You know, and so that she jumped on that felt forced. But they had already been sending signals earlier this year in January about something that we haven't talked about yet, which is this sort of investigative report story that, you know, about some sort of secret meeting that IFD politicians were holding with other conservatives and CDU and Austrian sort of far-right activists in a private hotel, in a hotel outside of Berlin, that they were planning sort of mass deportation campaigns of even Germans with citizenship. At the time, she already denounced that. Like, why would not that have been the moment to cut ties? I think she was just looking for anything that would cause international uproar, that would be in the news, and that she could finally say, look, that's not us. So yes, certainly there is this EU, on the EU-wide level, that, you know, the French have always ambitions to lead Europe, right? They're still a grand nation, right? To me, it felt like a domestic, you know, a gamble, especially with her, given her presidential ambitions.
Yeah. And that kind of takes us, the question of Germany and Europe, and that takes us back to I suppose, the big question, or at least it seems to me the central question that's hovering over German politics, which is the question of the Ukraine war. And we've touched upon it with we've touched upon it already by talking about, like we said, the defense minister and the education minister and the effort to screw up political tension in Germany with respect to kind of geopolitical rivalry with Russia and so on. But so they've made the case was made that Germany might have to reintroduce conscription, and now kind of they roll back from that. You say kind of you mentioned some of your normie kind of relatives seem to get fired up by this, but nobody else really does. And that seems to me very similar to these some kind of tentative efforts that have been made elsewhere to crank up political tension, float the idea of perhaps reintroducing conscription, boosting defense spending, this kind of thing. But it never seems to me particularly serious on the one hand. On the other hand, clearly the Ukraine war is tremendously serious for Germany because the consequences of the Ukraine war have been catastrophic for German industry, as well as the increased kind of energy prices for American liquid natural gas, German industry reshoring to the US in order to take advantage of green credits. And so all of these graphs that I've been seeing kind of shared on social media of German industry cratering and all of that seems to me very, you know, consequential and also directly related to the consequences of the Ukraine war. So I was wondering about your take on that, but also how far, again, that the consciousness of that is discussed or visible even in German public debate.
Yeah, there are some issues you mentioned here. Conscription, I'm not necessarily anti-conscription, right? There's a good argument to be made that if you have a citizen's army, that it might get harder to enter unnecessary wars because everybody's lives are at stake rather than just sort of professional soldiers.
No, indeed, yeah.
If you read the new book by Jack Ross from Sublation Media, he makes, maybe the argument isn't original to him, but I've come across it in his book, that the opposition to the Vietnam War in the United States didn't gain a mass basis until these sort of lottery drafts, where you wouldn't know if one day to the next you're going to be thrown into the meat grinder, that it wasn't sort of a left-driven opposition, it was a mass-driven opposition and so forth. The sort of remilitarization of Germany, yeah, it's weird because despite all the rhetoric, they don't actually seem to truly mean it, meaning spending more on the military. There was an article in the German media recently that there's some accounting. So the Germany says now it actually has reached its 2% GDP spending goal on defense, but it turns out they were like counting pension claims of former GDR soldiers and stuff like that. Don't hold me to the details, but it doesn't seem serious. I think Germany desperately wants the United States to stay. I think there's this incredible fear that Donald Trump is going to pull out of Germany, right? That the model of the past 30 years was that we can concentrate on our domestic economy, on social spending and so forth, and sort of leave our sort of national security to the United States and the Donald Trump factor. I think that gets overrated. I think allegedly there was an order made that Donald Trump gave to Doug McGregor in the last weeks of his presidency, like close the German bases. But you know, why wait until the last weeks if you had meant it? It would be, I grew up, my sort of relationship to the United States started when I was very young, growing up next to the second largest army base in Germany after Rammstein in Grafenwöhrfelsegg, in that corner in southeastern Germany. You saw a lot of United States military presence. It's key to a lot of local economies, these bases, right? Like my hometown, my home region would be thrown into economic calamity if the United States withdrew. But on a lot of the decisions surrounding the Ukraine war, my favorite moment from the Tucker Putin interview was not the meme material, let's go back 1500 years to the origins of the Slavic race or whatnot, moments. It was when Tucker asked him, Jeffrey Sachs recently sort of picked up on that in his interview with Tucker, when Tucker asked, like, so what's your read on Germany? And Putin said, I don't know, right? Who knows if he meant it? Who knows if he actually has a theory and a take? But a lot of it seems fairly irrational. I don't think they genuinely want a war with Russia. I don't think they know what that means, but so much in general beyond Germany seems like it's an autopilot, like on an escalatory autopilot, that maybe if we allow them to, if we give them our weapons and allow them to fire into Russia, that will help them win somehow. I don't think they've thought through what this means. I think it allows you to score political points domestically, but it all seems to be a little bit out of control right now. That's my read. I hope I addressed all the questions, because there were a few in that.
Yeah, I mean, so I suppose, you know, the kind of the mystery from the outside is the apparent inability for, at least this is constantly raised by critics, right, from the outside. So I'm thinking, for instance, of Thomas Fatsy on who's another Unheard writer, and he's particularly good at picking this up on social media, is the astonishing kind of self-abasement of German elites. And, you know, this is very visible with the Nord Stream, the refusal to, discuss or acknowledge the, you know, likelihood, if not almost certainty, that the US was, either gave the green light for or was directly responsible for the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. And I was very interested to hear what you said earlier, that, you know, kind of in Germany, it was envisaged as the start of a kind of future pan-European kind of coal and steel community style, project of integration. So I suppose, how is that felt in Germany, like this kind of sense of this inability to articulate your interest? Or is it just something which is only picked up by the populist kind of rabble rousers at the edges?
I would say the latter, that sense is there, because what else would there be? German national self-assertion, like that, like the word people, folk, is hard to get across, roll over your tongue in Germany. I mean, you got to give it to him. That one, I mean, it's not laugh out loud funny, but he tells this joke that, you know, an Italian, a Frenchman and a German go to a bar. The Frenchman chooses himself as French. The Italian is Italian. The German says, I'm a European, right? I think there's been a lot of bet on the sense that we are sort of the industrial powerhouse of Europe, and we are fully integrated politically into that, that our old sort of national ambitions in a certain sense have been realized, right? Like we are exporting capital to Poland and the Baltics, like the old regions of German political interests, but in a peaceful way. Now they're even exporting the jobs there and beyond, and for the factories there. Nord Stream, I got a good one on that. The Green Party is now calling for an official commission investigating Nord Stream. Did you know that? But do you know what they want to investigate? Not what happened to Nord Stream. They want to investigate why it happened, like why the Nord Stream pipeline happened. Like, how, right. There must have been corrupt dealings that the United States was always warning from day one that you don't build this pipeline. There were indeed some shady dealings that were, however, all legal, that a northeastern German state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern founded some sort of like pro-climate protection foundation that was funded by the state, but that really was trying to circumvent U.S. sanctions on the raw materials to finish building Nord Stream 2. And so the Greens are now like, why did this happen? Like, so not who exploded it and caused one of the biggest environmental catastrophes and an unprecedented attack on civilian infrastructure. There, the news is slow. When Wagenknecht asked the government, as a member of the Bundestag, you have a right to sort of ask the government to reveal some secrets and say, like, what is internally known about X? When she asked, like, what is internally known about the explosion of Nord Stream? She was told, we cannot tell you for the welfare of the state what we know. Then sort of the German... A German state's attorney said, the clues lead toward Ukraine, that this was a Ukrainian commando. Yeah, that story has been sort of reported in the West, right? Outside of Germany, which that's supposed to sort of ease fears that the United States did that. But how does that make it better? Like, Germany is a huge arms and capital supplier to Ukraine. So no, that was indeed, supposed to assure us that, that this country that we're sort of devoting ourselves so fully toward, that we're risking World War III, attacked our civilian infrastructure. That makes it better. But yeah, the Greens, again, they want to investigate, like, how come the pipeline was built in the first place?
Yeah, that's definitely a way of avoiding the question of Germany's self-interest in a, as you know, you've got to make a committed effort to avoiding the issue with that one. That's a great example.
So can I say something about the pipeline? That was not the first pipeline between Russia and Germany. Of course, there's the whole network that goes through Ukraine, through Poland, through the, you know, Black Sea and so forth. But it was not the first direct deal between German industry and the Russian state. This was the fifth such pipeline project. There were four before that. Attempts to build these pipelines between Germany and then Soviet Union have been going back to the 1950s.
Yeah.
It came close to being finalized in 1961, 62, but then the Berlin Wall came in between and the Kennedy administration essentially said no. When the Soviet Union invaded Prague in Czechoslovakia in 1968, 2 years later, they built their first sort of, they signed their first gas pipe deal, it was called. So despite the fact that they had invaded this country, it was sort of in the climate of detente, it was sort of, the United States said it's okay, right? And in the next sort of decade and a half, under Willy Brandt and then Helmut Schmidt, there were other such deals signed. So that it was not new. Christian Democrats, as committed transatlanticists, were always vocally opposed to them. Merkel ran in her campaign in 2005 opposing the Nord Stream pipeline, but in typical Merkel fashion, she let it just happen. Her leadership style was that when anything controversial happened, she kind of stayed silent for as long as possible. And when there was a fait accompli, she signed off on it, right? Yeah. And that was her sort of way of going about it. For German industry, it was a dream. It was assured gas prices. Yeah. Why they're acting so irrationally, so self-destructively, who knows? States can act irrationally. I don't think there's a rule in international relations studies that states always must sort of act like cold-hearted, logical
chess indeed. Player. No, you're absolutely right. And I suppose there are some theories that take it like that, but then they're always left stumped as to when states act irrationally, how they, the departure. I suppose what's fascinating with Germany is on the one hand, it's the paragon of, taken as the paragon of the pathologies of self-interest with the example of Nazism. But you could also take it as the paragon of the pathology of self-abasement as well, in terms of the inability to, to the extent of humiliating themselves so kind of publicly and openly and visibly, seemingly without political cost or consequences for, accepting being bombed by your own allies, like you say, whether that's Ukraine or America, whoever did it. So it's a kind of, it's a fascinating polarity. So one final question to wrap us up, which is about the much vaunted and kind of very widely discussed parliamentary elections to the European Parliament. We've already mentioned the fact of Le Pen and Meloni trying to kind of squeeze out the AfD in any kind of future national populist bloc in the European Parliament. So I was wondering what your feel is as to what might happen, how it's being discussed in Germany, if the AfD do well, or if the existing kind of system parties do less well in the parliamentary elections. How much difference does it make to politics in Germany specifically?
How much difference does the EU Parliament make? I think it's sort of regarded, what's the more important elections in Germany that are going to happen this year are three state elections in Eastern Germany, the four former states of the GDR. Those are the bastions of the AfD. They're especially in the state of Thuringia and Saxony. That's where they're very strong, right? The question was that there could happen a possibility where some parties like the FDP, who knows, even the Social Democrats might get eliminated, might not pass the 5% threshold you need to enter state and national parliaments in Germany, that those parties couldn't make it. That there's a situation in which none of the parties want to go into a coalition with the AfD, but that together they could not form a joint ruling coalition that would have more votes than the AfD. I think so. My read on the EU elections is that it's more about the sort of, they're taking the temperature about what's going to happen on a national level, right? And certainly It looked like just a few months ago, like in the East, like in Thuringia and Saxony, who knows, the IFD might have gotten as far as 40%. Like, that's unheard of on a national level at this point. 10, 15 years ago, it was, you know, for the history of the Federal Republic in its first decades, since 1949, it was normal for the CDU and SPD to garner 40%. It's going to be looked at as a success if the CDU gets 30%. Right, like they're comparatively strong in this disintegrated political landscape of so many sort of new forming parties. So the IFD will still gain compared to the last EU elections. I think they got 10-11%. Polling says they're now at 15%. So they will certainly look that the IFD would certainly look at that as a sort of defeat, because they were hoping to get at least 20-22%. By December, it looked like 25%. Like they might actually be the strongest party in the EU parliament. So I think the German establishment would be very self-congratulatory. The CDU is probably going to gain almost twice as many votes as the IFD. This will feel like the problem's been resolved. But as I mentioned earlier, maybe it's just delaying the problem, right? So the more interesting part is what will happen in these state elections to the state parliaments in the east of Germany. The German east is sort of... The voters there, they would historically in the last 20, 30 years vote more for Die Linke, for the left parties, out of a sort of memory of growing up in the GDR, that there were actually sympathies. People report now in the polls more and more so that they miss the good old days of the GDR. So it's this weird, I don't know, Saxony maybe is like the Alabama or something of Germany. You will literally see Trump flags there at rallies. Like, again, talk about the triumph of American idealism. Like
MAGA communism in East Germany.
Yeah. maybe. Yeah. So that's my read on that situation.
Just briefly on that note, how do you, Ostalgie has been kind of batted back and forth, and you've even had kind of internationally successful kind of cutesy Ostalgie movies, Goodbye Lenin and so on. I suppose maybe that's taken kind of a more threatening turn now internationally, that you have the former, the GDR, like you say, the former territories of the GDR, the bastion of the AfD, and it seems to have kind of flipped politically. And then you have these confusing, what seems kind of politically confusing on the surface, nostalgia for this... with this kind of socialist welfare state, at the same time very authoritarian, and then kind of extending to Trumpy sympathies. How'd you read all that?
I mean, the Ostalgie phenomenon, yeah, that was weird, but it felt not real. It felt like romantic. It felt consumerist. The people hated the GDR and the GDR. The mass protests were real. If I remember correctly, when GDR citizens were polled in 1989, they did support the continued existence of the GDR. The SPD's candidate for chancellor in 1990 was running in opposition to immediate reunification. So it was more fraught than the mass movement led on. But I think a lot of the sort of the Ostalgie, the nostalgia for the days of the GDR, stems from a disappointment with what happened in the 90s and subsequently. Right. So a lot of state businesses were privatized. It felt like a lot of public capital was privatized. And in return, Kohl promised the so-called blooming landscapes that, what you saw was capital flight out of the East in the 90s and 2000s. And also literally people were just moving to the West. It was losing population. The Nord Stream terminal terminated in northeastern Germany in a former state of the GDR. Those were supposed to be jobs. They were supposed to be getting those benefits, right? So, maybe there's a sort of underlying ideological commitment to growing up in those days. I don't know how it is among younger people in the former GDR who grew up without the memory of the GDR. My guess is that there's a little ostalgia among them, that that's more of a sort of boomer phenomenon there. But yeah, I mean, they continue the famous Monday rallies in Saxony, especially. That those Monday rallies were happening in 1989 every Monday in opposition to the regime. We are the people, we are the people, instead of the GDR, totalitarian government. They're continuing. They tend to be small. Sometimes there are these moments when they get bigger.
And the Monday rallies are what kind of still anti-generic kind of anti-system rallies, or?
Yeah. I mean, I follow all these just to keep myself informed. All these sort of Telegram channels, where you get sort of those voices and what they feel and how they feel about it. That's why the German government wants to ban Telegram. That's where you can watch Russia Today, the German language Russia Today broadcast. It's not that hard to find on Telegram that they want to ban that. So definitely, I mean, it was anti-COVID. I mean, most of these sort of anti-lockdown and then especially anti-vax mandate opposition was very prominent in Thuringia and Saxony, precisely those two strongholds of the AfD.
It's constantly fascinating to me, the kind of the backwash of old Cold War politics with the breakdown of that kind of the transatlantic era, I suppose, and the strange kind of combinations and unexpected outcomes it produces. Well, thank you very much for being with us, Gregor. You haven't made too many predictions, but we'll see how they hold up. We'll have you back on at some point in the future. So we'll see what happens with the predictions for the future. Well, for the Eastern elections, the kind of state elections, and then we'll see where we're at with the possible CDU Green coalition in future. But thank you very much for joining us and informing us about what's the most recent happenings in German politics.
Yeah, thank you, Philip. That was great.